This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega, who will be back next week. A year ago this month, Hurricane Harvey made landfall on the Texas coast, triggering 4 days of extreme rainfall. Harris County, which includes the city of Houston, experienced catastrophic flooding. Many residents, like Delicia Thomas, needed help. Her fiancé, 38-year-old Randy Belcher, was diabetic and stuck without his insulin, and he was having trouble breathing. The entrance to their apartment complex was underwater, so Delicia called 911.
Are you with the patient now?
He is there.
Okay, I'm sending a paramedics to help you now. You stay online. I'll tell you exactly what to do next, okay?
Okay.
Before the medics arrive, put away any pets, medications, unlock the door, and turn on the outside lights.
Okay.
If anything changes, you call us back immediately for further instructions, okay?
Okay.
Hours went by, and no one came. So, Delicia called again.
Yes, ma'am. And she told me to call back. If anything got worse.
We have units en route, ma'am. I don't know how long it's going to take for them to get there, though. You got to understand we're going through a hurricane. Just sit tight, okay?
But EMS was not en route. Her fiancé's condition was getting worse. 12 hours after her first call, she dialed 911 again.
We do have the information, and we will try to get an ambulance to you as soon as we can, ma'am. I need to disconnect to take another call, ma'am.
And again.
Tell me exactly what happened.
I called earlier.
Okay, so you already called 911?
Yes, ma'am, and I've been calling since midnight. Been telling me the same thing.
Okay, ma'am. We'll go ahead and update the call slip, okay, ma'am? And someone will get to you as soon as they can, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Another hour and a half went by. The situation was getting dire, so Delicia's friend Lois tried 911 on her behalf.
My name is Lois Pierce, and I'm calling on behalf of someone else.
Let them know that wait times right now are exceeding 12 to 14 hours. Okay? We'll get there as soon as they can. If they can have a white towel or T-shirt, something that they can wave out the window so the rescuers can see them, they need to be on the lookout for them from now on, okay?
And that's going to be by boat, correct?
Boat or high water truck or even Coast Guard and Air Force are rescuing.
Okay.
2 more hours go by. Randy is struggling to breathe. With tears rolling down her face, Delicia tried 911 for the 6th time.
Your first name?
Delicia.
Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
Right, I've been calling since midnight. And my
Okay, I'm sending the paramedics to help you now. Stay on the line, I'll tell you exactly what to do next.
After more calls, 911 call takers coded Randy as urgent and finally pushed to get the dying man immediate help. But it was too late. Randy's body lay dead in the apartment for 2 days before he could be retrieved. And yet, Randy is not among those counted in Hurricane Harvey's official death toll. Sherry Fink is the reporter behind a new story for the New York Times Magazine about failures of emergency response in Harvey's aftermath. Sherry, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Sherry, this was really powerful and emotional reporting in this story about the failures of the emergency response system after Hurricane Harvey. Can you tell us what primarily failed in the case of Randy and others like him who experienced these medical emergencies during the storm?
It was a failure to prioritize people who had a life-threatening situation in the midst of a major emergency. And so many, many people had floodwaters around their homes. Many people had some water in their houses. It took, you know, emergency response starts locally. The local resources were tapped out. The federal and state resources were having trouble getting in because of the storm. And so there weren't a lot of, you know, those high water vehicles, those boats early on. And if you step back and think about it, you want to prioritize those resources for the people who, in the midst of this mass emergency, need them the most. And that's what didn't work here.
And why? Was that a system-based, that there just wasn't enough of a plan for prioritization? Was it human error? Was it just, you know, the circumstances of a terrible storm?
Well, you could say it's all of the above, mm-hmm. but there was somewhat of a failure of logic in the system. So there'd been a lot of planning. Harris County, where this took place, which has Houston within it, mm-hmm. It's a county of over 4.5 million people. They've had a lot of storms in recent years. They've had a lot of flooding. They do a lot of planning. They have a whole emergency response system. And they believe, one of its leaders told me, that, you know, the goal is to reach people who have a life-threatening situation, even if it might not be due to flooding. So if they have a medical problem. The problem was that for that, the idea, the identification of somebody who's sick, which starts with that 911 system, all the way through to sending the local responders, then the local responders, if they can't get there, needing to raise the alarm and try to get resources from the county or the state or the federal system. And that complex chain of sort of links was broken and wasn't really established to make that happen in a very smooth way.
So walk us through this. From the moment of a 911 call, what would have to happen for someone to get the necessary care under the circumstances like during Harvey?
So the 911 system, people might be surprised to know, is primarily across the U.S. an analog system. So there's a common recognition that it needs to upgrade to like internet-based protocols so that in a storm like this, when the 911 call centers are overwhelmed, you could spread out those calls to other centers that aren't affected and have more effective call taking. So that's step one. And then making sure that the 911 call takers are able to do their jobs. From there, those call takers are kind of in a silo. They only can dispatch to the local fire and ambulance. In this case, the local fire station had no boats or high water trucks. They were, however, in charge of rescues. That's their job under the county system. So they were having a lot of trouble. Then in this particular part of Harris County, the ambulance system was completely separate from the fire rescue system. So when that call was dispatched to the EMS system, they didn't have boats either. So they had to coordinate with the local fire station. And those communications kind of broke down in the disaster.
So these problems, are they specific to Texas and Harvey? I mean, you said that most 911 systems are analog. I mean, is this common? And is this a problem for future disasters anywhere around the country?
Absolutely. It's, you know, our public safety systems don't get a lot of funding. We tend to forget about how important they are until we need them. And so as a result, they're poorly funded. A lot of the 911 systems, they're all either local or state jurisdictions. So there's like no federal mandate to upgrade, even though there's a common recognition that that needs to happen.
Sherry Fink is here with me. We're talking about her new reporting for the New York Times Magazine on the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey in Harris County, Texas. Sherry, I want to turn to the death toll numbers. There's been a lot of news in the last few days about Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico just revised its death toll number from an initial 64 people who died during that storm to nearly 3,000 people. 36 deaths have been attributed to Harvey in Harris County, Texas, but those numbers, based on your reporting, do not include people like Randy, who we heard about earlier, who died because of delayed care. How high do you estimate the actual death toll should be if you include people like Randy?
So I think the big difference here is that we saw in Puerto Rico that the official toll was standing at 64 people. It hadn't been revised until just 2 days ago.
Right.
And that was because it was focusing on people who died as a direct result of the environmental impact of a storm, like a flood, like drowning. That is how Harris County does their calculations. What the CDC now says is that that's not a full measure of the death toll of a major disaster. And that is why we saw the numbers go to almost 3,000 in Puerto Rico when mm-hmm. research showed that excess people died. They did a calculation how many people normally would be expected to die based on, you know, previous non-storm months and years, and saw that there was a big spike in deaths. I tried to look at that in Harris County, and from preliminary data, it does look like the month of August, more people died than one would have expected. Typically, the same number of people roughly die in July and in August. And that August last year, about 200 more people died than they did that July. So it's hard to tell exactly, and there will be more research needed. But undoubtedly, people like Randy, people like other people included in the story,
yeah.
also very much likely would not have died sure. if not for the storm.
Tell us about Randy. He's the father of, he was the father of 12 kids. What did his death mean for his family and his fiance?
So his fiance said that he was her best friend, not surprisingly. His mom said he was the glue that held so many people together in his family, in his circle of friends. And his life mattered. His death has left a huge gap in the family, and obviously all of those children who no longer have a father.
What would it take to get 911 technology nationwide to where it needs to be in order to save lives like Randy during a storm?
Well, it's interesting. Just getting a call from your phone to a 911 call center requires quite a number of steps, and it's everything from the carriers, especially now that most of us have mobile phones. The wireless carriers have to play along. They have to upgrade their technology. A lot of calls are misrouted now because they're, you know, our phones know where they are, our smartphones, but yet the technology that's used to locate you when you call 911 is not very accurate. It's based on cell phone towers. So it's everything from that to the call centers themselves being able to upgrade right. their networks.
Sherry, what do you see as the most urgent takeaway from your reporting? What can we learn for the future?
I think that for many years, we've seen that people are vulnerable in disasters if they're in hospitals and nursing homes. But there's been far less focus on, you know, where any of us could be out and have a medical emergency in the midst of a crisis like that and need help. So that really needs to be focused on. And I think we saw an incredible response, the citizens in Texas and Louisiana going out with their boats using Google Maps and mining social media to try to find people who needed help. And so the citizens can do that. Certainly our public officials and safety officials could do that too. So we really need to think about these people who could need help at home.
Sherry Fink is a correspondent at the New York Times, and she's the author of the book 5 Days at Memorial, about patients who died in a hospital during Hurricane Katrina. Her new reporting about Hurricane Harvey's aftermath is in the latest New York Times magazine, and you can find it online now. Sherry, thank you so much for all of your hard work and your reporting.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. Matt Katz here, in for Tanzina Vega. In 2015, environmental activist Berta Cáceres was presented the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize.
In our worldview, we are beings who come from the earth, from the land, and from corn. Protecting our rivers means giving our lives for the good of humanity and this planet.
Cáceres was an indigenous leader and land defender in Honduras. She led the Lençol people in their fight against a hydroelectric dam project on a river considered sacred by the indigenous community.
Let us wake up. Let us wake up, humankind. We are out of time. Our Mother Earth that is militarized, fenced in, and poisoned, where basic rights are systematically violated, demands that we take action.
But a year later, she was assassinated. Armed men burst into her home and shot her. And in 2 weeks, the trial of the 8 men charged with her murder will begin. Cáceres' story is emblematic of the threats and attacks environmental defenders face throughout the world.
Land and environmental defenders, they're basically people who are being attacked and sadly sometimes killed for simply protecting their land or their community's land and crucially our global environment.
Heather Iqbal is Senior Communications Advisor for the environmental and human rights group Global Witness. She joined us to discuss the latest Global Witness report, which analyzes the targeted killings of land and environmental defenders in 2017.
This year in 2017, 207 defenders were killed for protecting their land. And essentially what's happening here is land grabs, which people are resisting. And while the worst attacks can result in killings, wider than the large tally of 207 defenders, which, you know, is far too big, as the widespread use of harassment, violence, sometimes sexual assault, threats and abuse from people trying to grab those land from those communities who are just kind of speaking out to protect where they've lived for generations often.
You said 207 defenders were killed in 2017 for protecting their land. Where did these killings happen?
So they actually happen globally. Latin America remains the most dangerous place to be a defender. 60% of the deaths registered in 2017 took place across the region. Brazil saw the most deaths ever registered in 1 year in any country, with 57 deaths. And Mexico was also seeing a significant increase in killings over the last year from 3 to 15. Looking at Asia and the Philippines, there were more killings recorded there than in a single Asian country than ever before. So it is a global issue across different continents. And we have seen a year-on-year rise since we've been recording these attacks.
And give us a sense of some of the industries involved here.
Sure. So for the first year, we've seen agribusiness take over as the most dominant industry. So large-scale agricultural industries, which have replaced mining as the sector driving the most fatal violence. So that means defenders are losing their lives, basically protecting their land against people wanting to plant palm oil, coffee, soy, sugarcane. Mining is still, you know, an industry that drives a lot of attacks as well, as is logging. So there are a variety of industries, but I think it's significant that agribusiness has taken over as the most dominant sector, particularly given that so many of those products consumers use every day. Businesses are not doing enough to tackle the root causes of those attacks on defenders, and neither are governments in some cases. So it's a case of how much an industry can drive someone to, you know, grab land to make money, and what businesses and governments need to do to take responsibility for those root causes. So, for example, you know, businesses need to make sure that they're doing due diligence on their supply chain to, you know, ensure that there aren't people perpetrating these attacks so that they can feed that industry. And governments need to make sure that the right due diligence is done. You know, in some cases, it's being made easier for industry to do business quicker without the right checks by governmental policies. So it's a bigger responsibility by both businesses and governments that we need to see across the globe to address these issues.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Heather Iqbal from Global Witness, and we're talking about targeted attacks on land and environmental defenders. In the recent report that Global Witness released, you highlight the story of Hernan Bedoya, a Colombian man who was killed by a paramilitary group. Can you tell us his story?
So Hernan had built a biodiversity zone on his farm, and he was basically killed after protesting against palm oil and banana plantations on that land, which was stolen from his community. It's a really horribly violent case that he was taking his horse to the vet, and he was shot 14 times. Behind him, he leaves his 18-year-old son, Ramon, who has basically chosen to inherit this struggle against these palm oil plantations who want to develop an area covering his family's land and that biodiversity zone. You know, and I think the fact that Ramon has taken on this struggle is a real illustration of how defenders come to be. You know, they're often forced into a situation where they have to defend their land. You know, they don't go out intending to be a defender. And it just shows, you know, this young man, the courage that he's had to take to stand up to these palm oil plantations.
Tell us what's going on in Brazil. You note in the report that Brazil is one of the worst countries for defenders.
Yeah, so Brazil has sort of consistently seen a high number of attacks and deaths, and this year saw, you know, the most deaths ever registered in 1 year in any country. This affects both indigenous people and others. In one of the largest scale attacks, the Gamela indigenous people were assaulted with machetes and rifles in an attempt to seize control of the land, and that left 22 injured, some with their hands cut off. So it really is horribly violent, and months later nobody had faced justice for that incident, and it reflects a wider culture of impunity and inaction to support defenders in Brazil.
The current president of Brazil called your report fake news. There was this negative backlash to the Global Witness report. What's your response to what the president said?
We have always raised Brazil as a place where really more needs to be done to protect land and environmental defenders. And it's really important to flag that since we've started recording this data, we've criticized across the political spectrum of different governments that have been in power. So this really goes beyond politics for us. It's about really making sure that any government who is in power in Brazil, any president really takes the initiative and continues to work hard to protect land and environmental defenders. So we really want it to go beyond that.
Heather Iqbal is the Senior Communications Advisor for the Defenders Team for Global Witness. Heather, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Katz back with you on The Takeaway today, filling in for Tanzina. Good to be with you. Thousands of Arizona voters in Maricopa County had trouble voting during Tuesday's primary. 62 voting places were not prepared to process voters when polls opened due to equipment issues. The Arizona Republic and ABC Channel 15 talked to constituents outside of polling places.
I think they should just really care about more about their voters, because it didn't really feel like we were cared about.
They are overwhelmed. They don't have enough people staffed. They don't have enough machines or voting centers, I guess, for all these people.
I think that so many votes are being lost because of the unorganization.
I'm just more confused than ever.
It's just really frustrating because voting is so important, and so many people get turned off by difficulty and they don't vote.
So what happened? Jessica Baim is Maricopa County reporter for the Arizona Republic.
So recently in Maricopa County, we have implemented this new form of checking in to get your ballot. So it's supposed to be easier for the voters in that you just scan your ID and it will get you the correct form of ballot that you need to vote. But unfortunately, 62 of those polling places with that equipment were not set up and ready for voters on Tuesday morning. Now, it sounds like there was some sort of miscommunication between the Maricopa County Recorder's Office and a contractor they were using to actually set up that equipment. A lot of those machines, we were told, weren't even set up or plugged in and connected to the internet service to be able to accept voters when polls opened at 6 a.m.
Now, you had reported that the recorder's office who handled this process, they knew about these problems beforehand. They were trying to deal with it overnight. Why did they end up still using these machines if they knew they weren't working?
Well, they were working at most of the sites. Why they didn't implement some kind of backup strategy for those sites that weren't set up is something that we've been asking, along with a lot of other questions. They kind of went radio silent on us yesterday. So we've been trying to figure out, was there a backup plan in place? How long did it take for all of these sites to open? We were still hearing from voters that they were having difficulties in being asked to fill out provisional ballots, which, you know, a lot of voters don't like to do because it means that it won't actually be counted until later in the week. It can't be automatically counted like you expect it to be when you go to a polling place.
Right, of course. Is it clear yet who is to blame for this, whether it be the government or the company that created these machines?
You know, both of those entities are trading blame right now. The county recorder has said that he takes full responsibility, but there was discussion that, you know, it was the contractor who failed to send enough technicians to set all of this equipment. Now, we got our hands on the contract between the county and the company yesterday, and it does appear that the section of that contract that talks about how many people should have been available to set up the equipment could have been read in two different ways, and it was in fact read in two different ways by both the county and the contractor. Now, why a discussion hadn't occurred prior to Monday in which everything was confirmed, you know, that's one of our big questions as well.
So, Jessica, just one last thing. We heard from some voters at the top who were unhappy with the situation. Is there now concern that this could erode trust in the system in advance of very important November elections?
It is definitely something that is concerning to voters. There will be a lot more people voting in November, we expect, and there is some concern that voters might be frustrated or not trusting of the process, which is something that we're talking about across the country right now.
Jessica Boehm is Maricopa County reporter for the Arizona Republic. Jessica, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz. In advance of Labor Day weekend, we're going to end today's program with a look at the American worker. The official unemployment rate as of July was only 3.9%, and last week the stock market achieved its longest rise in history. Just this morning, the president tweeted, "For all of you that have made a fortune in the markets or seen your 401ks rise beyond your wildest expectations, more good news is coming!" Exclamation points. So, are you feeling it?
Hi, Lisa from Seattle. Most of us working people are still paid at pre-1980 levels, and that includes those of us on Social Security, but expenses have risen 5 to 15 times.
This is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon. On average, my total compensation has outpaced cost of living, though recently I'm about at par.
My name is Patrick. I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm a truck driver. We got a small raise last year, but minimum wage in Oregon is being raised rapidly enough that they're overtaking us. And I think the move to raise the minimum wage is really just a way to lower more of us into poverty.
This is Julia from Clayton, California. Gas prices went up, food prices went up. So I had to borrow against my home, and in order to get the new loan, I couldn't take any write-offs. So you bet my taxes went way up too.
James from Dover, Ohio. Yes, I have almost tripled my wages over the past decade. I contribute this to hard work and always looking for new opportunities.
Hi, I'm Cindy from Northampton. 1% and 2% increases on my salary can't keep up with the cost of living. Doesn't work.
In 2018, the median American worker is bringing home around $44,500 a year. But adjusted for inflation, that's not much more than what the typical worker earned 40 years ago. And according to new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, some workers are watching their wages fall relative to inflation. Meanwhile, CEOs have seen massive increases in their salaries. When asked by a reporter about wage stagnation in June, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell had this to say.
Everywhere we go now, we hear about labor shortages, but where's the wage reaction? So it's a bit of a puzzle. I wouldn't say it's a mystery, but it's a bit of a puzzle.
So I'm presenting this puzzle to our next two guests. Heidi Scherholz is Director of Policy at the Economic Policy Institute and a former chief economist at the Labor Department under President Obama. And Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown. He also served as chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor under President Clinton. Heidi, Harry, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So explain to us, is wage stagnation a puzzle, as Jerome Powell says it is? Heidi?
It certainly is perceived as a big puzzle by economists. We're seeing pretty low unemployment rates right now by historical standards. We're at 3.9%. The logic that economists use about why that should spur wage growth is exactly the same thing that any person on the street might think, that when your employer knows that you probably have other outside job opportunities because the unemployment rate is low and jobs are available, your employer then has to pay you higher wages to keep you. And so this tight labor market shifts economic leverage to workers. It means they have more bargaining power when their employer knows they have outside options. But bargaining power is, in some crucial sense, additive. And the other things that provide workers bargaining power, like strong labor standards, strong unions, those things have been decimated over the last few decades. And so now it takes a lower and lower unemployment rate to spur strong wage growth.
Well, I agree with a lot of the things that Heidi has said, but I would also emphasize a few more factors. Number one, productivity growth has been lousy. And it's really hard to have earnings growth without productivity growth. Now, some people will contest that and will say, you know, earnings haven't kept up with productivity growth, and there are some technical reasons for that, and too much of it has gone into healthcare rather than wages. But I think productivity is part of that story. I think some of what Heidi calls bargaining power actually reflects some market forces. I think technology and globalization have made it easier for employers to get work done in other ways, whether it's by machines or by offshoring work or jobs where Americans without a lot of education used to get paid well, have mostly been wiped out. Today, to have a good paying job, you need workers with more skills, with some post-secondary skills. Too many workers don't have that. And I'll say one final thing. Some of the productivity story is not about worker skills. It's about employer choices. Employers do have some choices about the quality of jobs mm-hmm. they create and whether they invest in their workers. And a lot of employers are going what we often call low road, just minimize costs, and they can still make money even without productivity. And I think that's a problem, too.
Harry, the average annual wage now is just over $44,000 a year. Can you give us some perspective here? How does that average compare to, say, the highest earners and then the lowest earners in the labor market?
Well, we know that the spread around any average has gotten wider and wider. So you have some people earning, you know, if you look at company executives, company CEOs, their earnings have skyrocketed. If you count their stock options, they are making $10, $20 million a year at the high end. But we increasingly have a lot of workers at the very low end, you know, earning close to the minimum wage or even less. And you see more workers at those extremes.
And those extremes have become more dramatic over the last 30 or 40 years, right?
Very much so. So there's really two separate stories here that are related to each other. One is a story about the stagnation at the average, but the other story is about inequality around that average.
Heidi, why is so much going to the top? I have this stat here that in the past half century, CEO salaries have increased 937%. That's according to the Economic Policy Institute. How do you make sense of that? Why is that happening?
One important backdrop to that, it wasn't always like this. If you look at the stats sort of post-World War II up to about the 70s, as the economy grew, as productivity grew, the wages of regular workers, of say the median worker, typical workers, grew in lockstep. It wasn't like everything was perfect in the 50s and 60s. There were a lot of disparities along things like racial and gender lines. But one thing really worked: as the overall economy grew, regular folks also saw increases. Starting in around the 80s, as the economy continued to grow and productivity continued to march on, sometimes growing faster, sometimes slower, but ever rising, wages for typical people just leveled off. Mm-hmm. That we have seen stagnation for the wages of most people for most of the period since the 70s. And the thing that is different between those two periods is things that provide bargaining power for workers. So things like, we know that, for example, the real value of the minimum wage is now more than 25% below now where it was 50 years ago in 1968. We know union coverage has declined dramatically. So those are the types of things that have contributed to this breaking of the link between overall growth in the economy and stagnation for most workers. And then the companion to stagnation for most workers is, we know that that growth in the overall economy was going somewhere. It's going to the very top of the distribution.
I want to play for you both an exchange between Senator Bob Corker, a Republican from Tennessee, and the Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell. This was back in July.
The stagnation of middle-class incomes, the relatively low mobility that we have, the disappointing level of wages over a long period of time, it's all of a piece, and it all does go to that. And I think the causes of these things are really deep. It's not something we can address really successfully over time with monetary policy, as you say. So I mean, I think
what are those deep causes?
So I think you know, part of it is, in our case, in the case of the United States, stagnation of educational achievement.
To both of you, what's your reaction to his answer there? Do you agree, Harry? Let's start with you.
I agree to some extent. Yes, I think the rise in educational attainment was not quite as rapid during the last two or three decades as we needed it to be. Again, technology and globalization wiped out good-paying jobs for people with only high school. And in their place, there remain good-paying jobs, but usually people need some post-secondary education to get that. And education didn't rise quickly enough, I think, to keep up. And I think that's affected productivity as well. At the same time, I want to emphasize that's not the whole story. The quality of jobs matter as well as the quality of the workers who fill those jobs. And I think we've seen shortfalls on both sides. And therefore, the solution's got to involve both sides as well.
I agree with a lot of what Harry said, but I would de-emphasize the education factor. And you can actually look for the footprints of, is that the cause of this in the data? And it doesn't show up so much. Like, if it were true that our wage stagnation and the lack of wage growth was because we needed more people with a college degree rather than people with a high school degree, we would see wage growth much faster amongst those workers with a college degree compared to workers with a high school degree or less. Because, you know, when workers are, if there's scarce workers with a college degree, employers will raise their wages to attract the workers that they need. And it is true that workers with a college degree are seeing somewhat stronger wage growth than workers with a high school degree or less, but it's not very much stronger. We aren't seeing a huge disparity in the wage growth between those two groups of people that would signal that that's a really substantial part of this problem. I really think it is more about, you know, employers behaving in a way that kind of wrests power from workers in a whole number of ways, and policymakers not allowing labor law to evolve to keep up with those changes.
And Heidi, but at the same time, fully half of American workers, even young workers, do not have any post-secondary credential. There are very large numbers of jobs, even not requiring a BA, that American workers aren't getting, and those markets remain very tight. So I continue to think, and by the way, the gap between college and high school workers is very, very large in America and much larger than overseas. And so I do think education is an important part of that story, but not the whole thing.
We've seen a big fight playing out over the minimum wage, but I was wondering if that has had an effect. We have a caller from Oregon.
My name is Patrick. I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm a truck driver. We got a small raise last year, but minimum wage in Oregon is being raised rapidly enough that they're overtaking us. And I think the move to raise the minimum wage is really just a way to lower more of us into poverty.
Heidi, what do you make of that perception?
One of the questions that you get when you raise the minimum wage, and so it sort of squishes the wage distribution, that doesn't have to do with the minimum wage. As we know, the minimum wage is now 25%, more than 25% below where it was once you adjust for its purchasing power than it was 50 years ago. So we need a huge increase in the minimum wage. The problem that gentleman was talking about is real, and it's that we have seen things like the decline of unions. We know the deregulation of the trucking industry, which he's in, decimated wages of truckers. So there's other factors that are keeping wages more in the middle down. We shouldn't, in that case, decide, okay, we're not going to raise wages for the people at the bottom. We need to raise wages for the people at the bottom and implement the things that would provide bargaining power to workers at the middle to also raise their wages.
And Heidi, tell me, what do you do then? You start to talk about what we can do about this. What can we do about this problem of wage stagnation? I would like to get your thoughts and then Harry's.
One of the things that is a useful backdrop to this is there's not one thing. I think there's a desire right now to look for the one big thing that's going to solve all of problems and solve inequality and raise wages for people across the distribution. And I think we have to realize wage stagnation for most workers and rising inequality is the result of decades of a really broad-based campaign, directly anti-worker policy or policies that just haven't been implemented to keep up with the changing labor market. It has happened in many different ways. So there's not one thing that can be done. But that said, if I had to pick the biggest factor that has led to those dynamics of rising inequality and wage stagnation for most workers. It's the erosion of union coverage.
And Harry, can you leave us with your single or a couple of solutions to the problem of wage stagnation?
Well, again, mine are more directly related to sort of trying to boost productivity. I think skills are really important. So my top choice would probably be to make it easier for American workers to get education credentials that the labor market values, including at the sub-BA level. I think that there's a lot of important action at community colleges and other places that could be done for workers to get some of the technical skills and other things that the labor market does value. But as I said earlier, it's not just about skills, it's also about jobs. And I think in America, we have to reward employers more who create good jobs, give them financial incentives, technical assistance, to try to create more of the kinds of jobs where, in fact, skills are valued and where productivity of workers can be higher as well. So that's where I put my emphasis, better skilled workers, better quality jobs.
Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown. He served as chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. And Heidi Scherholz is director of policy at the Economic Policy Institute. And she also served as a former chief economist at the Labor Department. Thank you so much to you both, and enjoy your Labor Day weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
And we've been hearing from so many of you about how you're doing in today's labor market. Has your pay kept up with your cost of living?
This is Dakota from Tampa, Florida. Is your question a joke? The recession killed my wages and my parents' savings.
Hi, this is Doug from Redmond, Washington. My wages have doubled over the past 10 years, with most of the increase coming in the last several years as I moved into strategic account management and sales roles.
This is Suzanne calling from Aiken, South Carolina. I lost my job in the recession in 2009. And I didn't find a new full-time job until 2011, which paid a little less than the job I lost. In that new job, I got about a 1% to 2% cost of living raise each year for the next 6 years.
My name is Doris. I'm calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Although I am not currently working outside the home, I now take care of my young grandson. My daughter and her husband are both teachers in South Carolina. The pay is so low that if my daughter stayed home, they would barely make ends meet on my son-in-law's salary. There would be nothing left over to save or spend on non-usual expenses like a medical bill or a home repair. And their mortgage is lower than rent in this area.
Kathy calling from Portland, Oregon. My wages have not kept pace in the least with the cost of living. I am frankly out of options of what I can cut. There's only so much, and I've hit that bottom. Wish it were different.
Thanks to everyone who weighed in on this question. And the takeaways, Amy Walter will also be diving into this issue in the coming weeks. Amy wants to know, how much is the economy going to affect the way you vote this November? If you want to weigh in on that, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, our number here is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz. Tanzina Vega will be back next week. This is The Takeaway.